This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today on the show, we're shining a spotlight on one of Canada's most dynamic and inspiring entrepreneurs. She has beauty galore, brains, and bold business savvy, whether it's in the boardroom or under the bright lights of Canada's longest-standing reality TV show. Of course, that's CBC's Dragon's Den. And it goes even further than that. She represents a new generation of leadership defined by resilience, reinvention, and of course, I'm talking about Michelle Romano, serial entrepreneur, television personality, board director, and venture capitalist. Michelle was also the youngest judge to join Dragon's Den in 2015, and she's been dazzling the dragons, the founders, and viewers on the show for 11 years now. She's a trailblazer in the world of tech and finance. I even talked to some young tech guys in their 20s who were raving about her. The co-founder of Clearco, a company that is revolutionizing how businesses access capital. And as mentioned, she's a powerhouse investor on the popular hit show Dragon's Den, where she's known for her sharp instincts, bold decisions, and unwavering belief in innovation. And I'll even say, I also notice a real compassionate piece in you. I watched a lot of episodes. You'll tear up very naturally. You have to say, I'm so sorry to someone, not today. From building companies to navigating personal and professional pivots, she reminds us that success isn't just about what you build. It's about how you rise, how you evolve, how you mentor others, which is your newest thing, and how you keep moving forward. So before we meet her, let me just tell you a little bit more about her. Tech titan Michelle Romano is a serial entrepreneur. She started six companies before her 35th birthday. Wow. And I've mentioned a dragon on CBC's hit show, Dragon's Den. Also the co-founder and executive chair of Clearco, which is actually the world's largest e-commerce investor. It's invested over $5 billion into 10,000 entrepreneurs in 13 countries. Prior to this, she even founded an app called Snapspace, acquired by the American tech giant Groupon, and Buytopia, acquired by Emerge. Romano joined Dragon's Den in 2015, so she was their youngest and is still their youngest judge to date. And Clearco, which we've talked about. And Clearco earned unicorn status by 2021, making it one of only 23 fintech unicorns in the world to be founded or co-founded by a woman as of 2022. A prolific investor, she was named one of Fortune's 40 under 40, a young global leader by the World Economic Forum, one of Canada's 100 Most Powerful in Canada by WXN, and Canada's Angel Investor of the Year. Wow. Romano has created digital solutions for many of the world's leading brands, including P&G, Netflix, Starbucks, and Cirque du Soleil. Her work has been profiled in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Fortune, TechCrunch, and the Globe and Mail. In 2021, Romano was honored the RBC's Women of Influence Innovation Award. Romano is a director for Vail Resorts. That's very cool. BBTV and Queen's School of Business. Previously, she was a director for Freshii and Whistler Blackcomb. Awesome. Romano also co-founded the Canadian Entrepreneurship Initiative nonprofit with Sir Richard Branson and is the host of the Audible original podcast, The Revisionaries. I can't wait to dive into the story, the mindset, and the magic of Michelle Romano. Michelle, longest bio in the history ever. Congratulations on all of this and welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Michelle, you really are a huge star and a huge celebrity in Canada. I've had 650 people on this show in the last 7 years, but you're really known and not many names that I say before the show and people go, oh my God, Michelle Romano. Oh my God, that's so cool. You're also a huge celebrity all over the world. You've made it onto the global stage and you went on to champion Canadian tech globally. As mentioned, you're the youngest dragon on Canada's longest running reality TV show, CBC's Dragon's Den. You've been doing that gig for 11 years now, which is like 100 years in Hollywood. Like, that's a long time to do a gig.
A long time. This will be season 12 for me.
Wow.
Starting in a week.
Oh my gosh. The 22nd season's about to start.
Yeah.
You're a tech mogul, serial entrepreneur, and even a new mom, your best startup yet.
Best startup for sure.
You're a wunderkind, really, in every sense of the word, and you really possess extraordinary talent in this business stratosphere. But before we get into your rise as the tech mogul you are today, missteps and all, which of course leads to momentum and to success, we have to have those to rise. I'd love to go back to the beginning of your story as a little girl on a farm in Regina, Saskatchewan, with chores that included everything from mowing the lawn, pulling weeds, and even changing car tires. And yeah. You said there were no boy tasks or girl tasks. There was just a farm mentality of when there's work to be done, you just do it.
Yeah.
How did that early experience shape your work ethic and the way you navigate your career?
Yeah. So I was in Regina. So we had so many people on the farm. And I just remember growing up in a place where everyone just worked hard. And there is a part of like farming mentality when you're from Saskatchewan that is, if you don't get up at 6 a.m. every morning and feed your animals, they will die. And I think sometimes we're in a world of a holiday and a this and any excuse not to work and we'll take it. It's just not the case when you have animals.
Right.
And I think that was just a part of my upbringing because everyone in Saskatchewan is kind of from a farm or from the farm mentality. Yeah. So even though we grew up in the city, that was such a part of my childhood. I think the next thing that I really remember is I was one of four kids. I was the first. There was three girls and then a boy. And so I had parents that were really, I was just going to do things. And it didn't matter if that was driving my little car around or mowing the lawn. Like, I just had to do everything. And I had just no idea that there was tasks that were or seemed gender specific. And I think that was a really important part of my mindset is that I grew up without some of these boundaries around what we think are masculine versus feminine tasks. And I feel really grateful always today because people are like, well, has it been hard for you as an entrepreneur, as a woman? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, there's lots of hard moments, but it's just generally hard to be an entrepreneur. I think it was hard for my grandmother, right? Who was born in 1912 and her career opportunities were school teacher, nurse, or secretary.
Wow.
It was a very different set. And I mean, this is two generations ago. This is not like forever ago.
Right, right.
And so I think back to that and I think about how terrible of someone's secretary I would have been. Because I have too many opinions of my own. And just the opportunity that I had as a founder, given this generation, I've really always been grateful for. But I think that there was this huge part of my childhood around believing and being asked to do anything that I really grew up with that mindset and continued that on.
Like you're really not a diva at all. You're so humble and you're so down to earth. And I'm wondering, I also read that not every venture works out, and yet you've continued to build and grow. Like Oprah always says, you know, from great disappointments and failures and setbacks yeah. come great opportunities and great growth, if you look at it that way.
Yeah.
How have the missteps along the way, because there were a couple of the caviar story, which I'll tell in a moment, you'll tell.
Yeah.
What did those early setbacks teach you that success alone couldn't?
First of all, I'm not a diva because I'm a founder at like my truest, true sense. This is a job that takes a strip out of you all the time.
Yes.
And if it's not taking a strip out of you, you're not really challenging yourself and you're not really building something that the world hasn't seen before. Because the cycle of being an entrepreneur is you start and everyone thinks you're crazy. Then you slowly start to join and people get really excited.
Yeah.
And then a second later, they start to compete with you.
Right.
So there's no moment where you're like, oh my gosh, you built this. You're on stage. It's like, oh, now we have to get ready for the next chapter of this, which is everyone's stealing my idea. They don't have to do the iterations and the hard work to figure out the product market fit. And there they are. And so I think as much issues as people give a lot of the entrepreneurs in this world, I think most of us, and I've met many of them, are just very down-to-earth people because it's a very down-to-earth job.
For sure.
And then there's a lot of things that don't work out. And so whether those are missteps or mistakes or failures, whatever you want to call them, like 80% of your job as a founder is 80% of things you try are not going to work. And there's a lot, right? And so we talk about, you know, I always talk about my early caviar story. I mean, great business, wrong timing. You can't start a luxury business in a recession. When we were running Bitopia, we started tons of other digital companies during that time. So I think that most people don't appreciate that being an entrepreneur is 80% of your ideas are not working. And those are not ideas you tried like in the middle of the night that no one sees. Those are things that you put out on your social media, you try to get people excited about, you ask for support from your community. And so this is why it's very hard to become a diva in this role.
Absolutely.
And perhaps the people that are not at that same level of challenge that they were in the early days, because this is very, very difficult to be good at. And that's the process of innovation. You have to look at the world and you have to see it operating a little bit differently.
Absolutely. It's even like science. Like my husband, Dr. Liebrach, he experiments. They don't always work, right? Like the ones that work are very few and far between. So you keep at it. Fall down seven times, get up the eighth. That's got to be your mentality.
Sure.
Your business ventures began as a Queen's University student in 2006. You studied engineering, and you even said, I'm not sure I would have gone into civil engineering and sciences unless I was pushed into it. My father was very influential in pushing me into engineering, which I was very grateful for. Your father, Marvin, was also the CEO of the Calgary-based oil and gas company, Nexen. And you said you were grateful for his push because, as you say, engineering is extremely hard, so you learn to work hard. How do you think a study in engineering further helped you become so successful in your chosen career? Because that's a tough, and I love that one of your 10 favorite things that Michelle can't live without is, of course, your iron ring.
Yes. Yeah. I love my iron ring. And I'm very grateful that my parents pushed me to study engineering. I think it's an incredible lens to see the world technically and scientifically.
Yes.
And you can really be a very good business person because you can suss out things that are like not even possible versus, you know, that's actually a good idea and plausible. The other thing is it's just very hard. There are days and challenges in engineering where there is either such abstract physics concept or such abstract math concepts where you're sitting there and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm like really only understanding 20% of this lecture right now. And I'm going to sit down and I'm going to force myself to go through this book and go through these exercises. And I think it was very useful for a couple of reasons. The first is that it taught me to think technically and scientifically and be a problem solver. But the second is it made me incredibly strong at math. And I always say like business math is like the easiest math. But I think that that's also been really important because there's no question that when you're in meetings, it's really important you can do numbers very quickly in your head. And again, it goes back to that first concept of, I just didn't even hear the paradigm that women are bad at math. I never heard that. I never like knew about it. I never like thought that was a possibility. And it wasn't like I didn't go to school with other little kids, but I think that part of my belief in that, I just ended up liking it. And I never thought twice that I was a woman and that I shouldn't be there. But I think I have been in a lot of male dominated professions.
Yes.
If you think about it, I was in engineering.
Yeah.
Then I was in fishing.
Yes.
Then I was in the early internet, which was e-commerce.
Yes.
I was then in fintech and finance, again, very male dominated. Media is probably the most female dominated industry that I've been a part of. But I just have always seen that as an advantage. People look at me and I'm different, and there's six Michaels and there's one Michelle. And so I've just always said, I'm just going to be the memorable one.
So cool. I love that. I really love that. I love that you were just always industrious. When you were studying at Queen's, you started your first business, the Tea Room, a student-run coffee shop aimed to be a zero consumer waste cafe. And it was hugely successful. And I researched it, and the Tea Room is still flourishing and is known still as an environmentally sustainable cafe at Queen's University. That is so cool. And the other thing about you that I found fascinating is, Michelle, that you never really had a financial cushion to fall back on. Your parents could have given you one, but they chose to end their financial support for you when they paid for your education. Mm-hmm. And all of your money to start your companies really came from business competitions.
It did.
And that's very cool. Do you think part of your success derived from the fact that you weren't spoon-fed and you had to figure out how to start making it happen for yourself? Like, is there sweetness to achieving success on your own as opposed to being handed everything on a silver platter?
Yeah, I think I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and you spend a lot more time thinking about this when you have a daughter, even though my daughter is one, so she's early. Look, I think you have to let your kids go at some point, and they have to become adults at some point, and they have to become independent. And so there is a threshold of, I think, you can make your kids probably struggle for too long, right? And there's things that you can give them. But I think the most important thing you can give them is ambition, and you can give them education. And I think that was a really important part of, I was very determined to prove everyone wrong, right? I think that I was lucky enough to find Anatoly in my first couple of years of university.
Third year university.
You know, and he was the one that was like, we have to build a business. And I think that that was early enough in my life that it shaped my ability to be an entrepreneur. I think if I hadn't have found him, I would have been a great corporate executive somewhere, but it would have been way different. And so I was adopting kind of like my nerd behavior that I gotten and being good at school with, then the ability to take risk, I think allowed me to become a really good founder. And I think it was tremendously grateful to my parents for supporting my education in my early years. And I think it was equally as important that they said, look, you're on your own. We, you know, I'm sure we won't let you starve if you really get into trouble. But I really did. They didn't give me any financial support after I was done school. And I really felt like, okay, I got to make this work on my own. It was funny because I was going through my closet the other day and I'm like, I've just lost my baby weight. So I'm just like now back at like my normal size 6, size 8 that I've been most of my life, right? And there's all these clothes from H&M and Forever 21. And I just remember for the first decade of my life, I didn't buy a single piece of expensive clothing and a single piece of non-costume jewelry. And that discipline, I think, was important for me.
So good. You know who would love you? And my late father was a very well-known chartered accountant who became an Order of Canada in 2002, amazing, given his award by Adrian Clarkson. And he loved people like you because you're self-made and you have a confidence. And I'm wondering if that was something your parents gave you and fostered in you, or do you think it's just part of your DNA? That's who you are.
So there's been so much research in confidence, and there was this move in the early 80s that was like, we just need to make more kids more confident. We should just tell them that they're great. And, you know, we should just, and it didn't work because confidence is this like very specific metric that comes from literally mathematically. I think it's you challenging yourself about 10 to 30% more than you can do.
Yes.
And then being able to do that successfully. And almost all of personal growth in any form of growth, whether you're learning a subject or whether you're learning a new sport or whatever, yes, it's like you're constantly challenging yourself. Yes. But if you're challenging yourself at 100%, if you're learning to ski and then you're like, I'm going to do this jump, you're going to get no confidence. You're going to injure yourself. So it doesn't work when it's these mammoth steps, but these 20 to 30% yes, steps times going, I think is really, really important. And so I can actually remember some inflection points in my life that were really important to me. So the first is that, because now we're really going back into my early life. The first is that I went to school in Regina and I had two best friends. So it was like three girls. And I remember I was the dummy of the three of them. And it's really funny. One of them worked for the Supreme Court. She was very smart. She was a lawyer. And the other one became a doctor. But I remember one of them could play piano better than me. And one of them could read faster than me. And my whole sample size when you're in grade 4 or 5 are like these two people. Like, you know, you have no idea of the world of other people ahead of you. And I don't think my report cards were bad. I wasn't doing particularly bad in school, but I remember constantly feeling behind. So that I think was like really important because I felt like the underdog. And then in this kind of magical transition, my dad gets a job that moves us as the family from Regina to Calgary when I'm in grade 7. And so I remember starting grade 7 and I like, I'm working super hard. I'm like super scared. I like don't know the curriculum from, you know, Saskatchewan and I'm bringing it to Alberta. Yes. Like most people don't worry about this. I was obviously very worried about this. I was a very ambitious young kid. And two things happened when I was in grade 7 that I think were actually like, I still think about today. So the first is I remember getting my report card in the first term and I like worked so hard to try and be good. And my teacher comes up to me and she goes, we would like you to know of all 100 kids, you have the highest average of anyone. And I was like, that's impossible. Because my sample size is 3 and I'm the worst. So I was like, I don't think it's possible that I can do that. And I was like, oh my goodness. And then I had the same teacher really tell me and encourage me that I should start doing some extracurricular activities because we really reward students that are well-rounded and do extracurricular activities. And I thanked her for that advice. And then the second thing that happened when I was in grade 8, and this is like, I can't believe I remember these stories, was I had always played piano competitively. I had done the Royal Conservatory of Music program, and I was writing my grade 6 or my grade 8 exam when I was in grade 8. Wow. I remember if you get the highest mark, so they mark you like on a scale of 1 to 100, and I got the highest mark in the province of Alberta, and I can still remember what the envelope looked like. And they're like, you got the silver medal for piano. I competed with all these kids in Qantas. And the fact that I was like the best at one thing that I tried really hard at, I think really showed me that if I put my mind to something, I could be really good at it.
Sky's the limit.
And I don't think you can make up these activities for kids.
Yeah.
A participation medal is not the same as knowing that everyone worked hard. We cannot remove the competition out of life.
True.
I remember I went to all of these Qantas piano competitions, and it's like so, it's so scary. I mean, I think my poor mother, she almost peed her pants for me every single time. She was so nervous for me.
Totally.
But it is the art of performing and like sitting there quietly being like, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm really scared, was very instrumental. But your question was really good, which is what gives confidence? And it's that mechanic. And so I don't think I've ever, and I've had lots of moments where I haven't been confident, right? I've had years in my life where things hadn't gone well and you just kind of feel like garbage. And you're like, oh, did I lose my touch? What is this? And I just go back to like hard work and discipline and get 10% harder every single day.
Absolutely. That's what I was saying. And I read about your piano and how you excelled and you came out on top. And I think you were the kind of person and are the kind of person that aims for an A plus in life. And people who do that do end up getting an A. If you aim for a B plus, you're going to get a B or a C. You aim for an A plus.
Seems like if you aim for the floor, you'll hit it, is my other favorite way to put this.
Totally. And in a way, it was good that you had those running mates, right? Because those friends of yours were your running mates and they set the bar high and you rose to it.
It was the best. And I think about these dynamics all the time. You want to run faster, run next to someone who runs 5% faster than you.
Of course, of course.
And I think the other thing that we can use is just a pure practical piece of advice is when you just are out of this mindset, I find the gym is one of the easiest ways to reset this because physical activity is one of those things where you can get 5% better a week, right? You can increase your weight just a little bit. You can do another 3 push-ups that you couldn't do yesterday. And that progressive overload feeling is just enough to be like, oh yeah, I remind myself of this physical.
I can do this. Get up and lace up and I can do this. And
exactly.
So
get up and lace up. And, I like that.
And from a very good friend, she knows who she is, who always says that to me. You ran a marathon. You did very, very well. You're even thinking about a triathlon. Is that still in the works?
Oh, I have to think about if I should do a triathlon now. So now my physical activity goals are as strong as possible, as least injured as possible.
And you also did a trick that I read about that I loved where you were in the marathon and you pretended that the beginning was just a warm up.
Yes.
And I love that you did that. And then when you actually started to take it seriously, you're like, oh, I only have 10K left.
That's exactly what I did. I was like, oh, you're doing a 10K warm up and another 10K warm up. And like, imagine you're just running around the block. And then the last 10K, I was like, this is the race, Michelle. You better get your bum moving.
That is so brilliant. We did a little breathing off the top, off camera. Do you also meditate? Is that part of your yoga or any of that stuff? Or is it more like?
No, this is so important. So I've done a couple of things in this vein before. So like the breathing is very important.
Yes.
I wish I had a person like you who would remind me all the time to breathe. It's like, I know we're in such a funny world and it's like so funny when people's Apple Watches remind them to breathe.
I'm breathing.
But here's what I do. I do try and like do some level of journaling and I go through phases where I'm like better at this and worse through this. But I do think trying to solidify, here's the things that happened today. Here's the things that I'm proud of. Here's the things I could have done better is like a really important personal part of growth. I really do believe in hypnotherapy. I think when I talk to my hypnotist, I'm not under, I know this sounds like crazy to most people, but she helps me, gives me like crazy visuals in terms of things that I should imagine or go to or recreate or think about that are really cool. And I think there's a huge part of putting your brain into the theta state that do help with things like that. And it's a great reminder I should do some basic meditation. I think I have like a very active brain. And so it's very difficult shut your brain off. And I know that's the whole point. I know the leaf like is going down the river and you're supposed to like let
the cloud is running by. So you should join us one time. I actually lead this group called Aeropreneur, Leslie Gottlieb, Aeropreneur Community, Monday mornings. I've been doing it 10 or 11 weeks in a row now, 6:15 in the morning. And I lead them on the meditation and then they journal. But it's amazing how it just sets them up for the week, you know, little visualization, affirmation. It's just really lovely to do it. You realize I can't worry about what's just happened. I can't worry about what's about to happen. I'm right here, right now, and all of that. And it just gives you that mental break. Like it's a
totally
it's a good practice. Okay, we've talked so much and we have so much to cover. You did do the caviar gig. And I just, the thing I love about that is that not only did you learn to catch, gut, and clean fish, you also became scrappy and built something from nothing. You made $100,000 in that first year. And you've said a very interesting thing, that fishing is in many ways was one of the most important parts of your story. And I quote, "It was where I learned that I just had to be scrappy if you wanted to get something done. And there was going to be just a constant supply of obstacles that made no sense." And you also joked and said, "How do we find the one fisherman that didn't own a fishing boat?"
Sure did.
What are, just briefly, are the lessons you learned from that entrepreneurial foray? Don't answer that just yet. We're going to go on a short commercial break. More with Michelle Romano from CBC's Dragon's Den when we come back. Be right back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We are back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio. I'm here with Michelle Romano. And before the break, Michelle, you were about to tell us about some of the lessons you learned from your first entrepreneurial venture in the caviar business.
Yeah. So I think that, let me go back and go through this story again, because I think it is very, very interesting. So the first is that we wanted to be entrepreneurs and we were searching for opportunities. So we were the ones that had figured out that worldwide supply of caviar was down by 95%. We had overfished the Caspian Sea. They could farm raise this product. We then entered a bunch of business plan competitions with the idea to do a caviar farm. We won $100,000 at business plan competitions, which is like great, until I tell you we needed $6 million to start a fish farm. So we had like barely scratched the surface of what we needed to do. And then, so to be successful, I think we figured out very early that we needed to be scrappy. We were 21 or 22 years old at the time.
Wow.
We were really young. And then we got out there and it was like a complete show. We just, we couldn't get the license. We had to figure out how to get the license. We couldn't find a fisherman, the fisherman that we found, and have a boat. We didn't have the right gear. We had to get a processing plant. Like it's just, it was like a comedy of errors. And it was my first comedy of errors, and your first is always the most memorable. And being a CEO, as much as there's some glory associated when you do well, it also is very unglamorous because you are constantly performance managing people. You are constantly telling people what the standard is, what is good enough, you know, if something is not working out, all of that type of stuff. So I think that that was kind of what I took away from that.
Wow. You really exhibited this entrepreneurial drive since you were a teen. And we talked about the piano competitions where you did extremely well. Everything you did, you went on to co-found the app SnapSaves, mm-hmm. the group buying platform Buytopia, not to mention investing $5 billion plus dollars into 10,000 companies globally. You became a unicorn where your private company was valued at $1 billion. Like, who has this? And, like, it's just crazy. And then you get this show. And before we even unpack Dragon's Den, which I think is the coolest thing that you've really done. And I do think to be on a show for 11 seasons on the CBC as really the star of the show, because when you say Dragon's Den, and I know there's other people and I know your friends, all of them, they're all great and they come and they go, but you're sort of the star of the show.
Thank you.
What would you say, Michelle, drives you so relentlessly in the pursuit of excellence and success and competition and doing it and making it happen? Like, what drives you? What is it in you?
So I don't know if you can fully teach ambition. I've thought a lot about this, especially after having a daughter. Like the single most important thing I can give her is ambition and hard work. Yeah. And if you have those two things, you're kind of unstoppable.
Yes.
Because that drives a level of resilience, that drives a level of creativity and curiosity. And those become byproducts of your ambition. I think that there was like a couple of maybe key points. My dad grew up in a two-bedroom farmhouse that didn't have a bathroom. My mom was an immigrant from Czechoslovakia, and they didn't have a lot of resources. My dad didn't have any competitive advantages growing up. Yeah. And so I was like, wow, if he can make it, and he ended up running an oil company, I was like, I got to be able to make it with some level of competitive advantages. I think that was my first thing, as I felt like I had really big shoes to fill.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, that can go either way, right? Sometimes when people have parents that have done well, they don't get ambitious. And so I think there was this combination of, I felt like I could constantly keep getting better, like the story about piano and the story about these two girls where I felt the dumbest constantly.
To the doctor, yeah.
And then I think what took over in my early 20s is that if you care about an issue, the absolute best way to make a difference in this world is to build a company around it.
Wow.
And the impact you can have on that is pretty incredible to me, right? I feel like I've gotten some like extraordinary life experiences. I've met most of the great founders and heads of state and like all sorts of people. That would have never happened at a regular job for me. That happened because I took the risk to build something. And so I think there was another part of, if you want the impact and you want to skip the line a bit, you have to go build something. And that was a really early part of my mechanic. And it's the fastest way to do this. And so I think the more we can encourage people to become entrepreneurs, the better. Like, they are the builders of societies. They are the builders of the change we want to see. And so I think after I understood that part, I was very ambitious. And then, you know, early success, you kind of get a taste, you kind of see what it feels like, you learn a little bit about yourself, you build a little bit of a network, and those things all build on one another.
Wow, wow, wow. Really incredible. So unless you've been living under a rock, guys, for those of you who don't know, of course, Michelle Romano has been on CBC's Dragon's Den for 11 seasons, going into season 21. It's season 20 right now. You can watch them all on CBC Gem and CBC. It's the longest running Canadian reality TV show on CBC, where entrepreneurs pitch business ideas to a panel of wealthy investors who are called Dragons for funding. The show showcases pitches, negotiations, and business strategies to secure investment for products and startups. It's a premier platform of Canadian business innovation. So I just wonder if you could tell us, there's so much I want to ask you about this, but you've had incredible staying power on Dragon's Den, which isn't easy in a world that's constantly evolving, and especially in the fickle world of showbiz, which I know that world very well. Yeah. What do you think has been the key to your incredible longevity and longstanding seat in the Dragon's Den?
I think it's just because I'm a founder at my core, and I get on that show every day, and I imagine what it was like to stand on that pitcher's mark, because I do that every day. So I think that's probably the first component. The second component is, I'm an extremely diverse personal investor. I mean, it is hard to over-exaggerate the scale that Clearco has. Clearco has invested more than $5 billion in 10,000 different companies. I have seen every business model on the planet, almost. I mean, Anatoly and I started over 20 years ago looking at different business models. We have not heard thousands, but tens of thousands of pitches over time. And so this is truly one of those things where I just naturally know like a little bit about a lot of things.
Yes.
And a lot of different chapters of how technology took over different parts of the internet, because we were so diverse in how we invested. So this isn't like we had a portfolio of 20 companies and some did well and some didn't do well. I saw thousands and thousands of companies. And so I can pick up the pieces that I'm excited about. And I have, I think, really smart questions for a lot of the people that come from my personal experience of trying something and it not working. So I think that all of that is just a part of staying in show business. And then I think the third thing is, I close deals. I've invested now millions of dollars in Dragon's Den companies. I've had great success stories like Endy, sold for almost $100 million. Monos, who's the luggage company that's become like a global brand. There is even a couple from last season that are really exciting. So I do a lot of work with these companies. Like I have founders that we'll spend a week together, like working every day with. And this is not something that is time light. To like mentor an entrepreneur and to create another incredible business is really hard. And I think it was a really cool story last season. What we did is we did an episode called The Full Circle, which old pitchers that had been successful came back.
Yes. Yes.
For an episode of Dragon's Den. And so one of the early founders I invested in, Mark LaFleur, Black founder that started a meat delivery company where you can order a box of meat and it's delivered to your door. And Mark and I, oh my God, we fought so much in the early days. We had like such a productive pull in terms of this. And then we helped him get his exit for $17 million. And he came back as a dragon. He's become a race car driver. He's built another AI company. He's run not only a marathon, he's run an ultra marathon where you run 100 miles. Like this is like so mind blowing that he could do this.
God.
And then he did that through a mountain range as well. He's like a really impressive human being. And it was like so emotional and like so exciting for me to see him come back as a dragon this year. And so I think just having some of those full circle moments is really special.
Michelle, do you know, like within, I think like it's like American Idol, like do you know within the first 10 seconds when someone's making a pitch, they've got it? Do you sort of know? Not necessarily.
No.
So it's not just first impressions.
No. I mean, look, everyone has a first impression. And like, if you're the last pitch before lunch and everyone's tired, I'm sure you're using a bit more of your first impression bias brain than your objective brain. So yeah, I won't lie. Present yourself well, know your pitch, pick a great outfit, et cetera. Yes. Every business is a bit of a puzzle. And I think about it like that. There's like, who are you as a founder? Do you have a personal mission on making this work? Do I like where the industry and the timing is on the actual industry? Do I like what your first product will be? Do I think this founder is resilient enough to pivot? Do I think he or she has the capability of being able to sell a company one day? And so I think that you can get some level of like chutzpah and like confidence in the first couple of seconds. But the actual mechanics of, is any of this going to work? You need to listen for a bit longer, for sure.
A bit longer. And I wonder, do you look for somebody who's humble like you and down to earth and who's not cocky and thinks they know it all? Because I've seen that a lot on the show where people just get too cocky, ask for too much. They go around the wheel one time too many, as my dad used to say, and they lose it.
Around the wheel one time too
right?
many. That's true. Yeah, there's this very... It's this coachability concept. And there's this very important dynamic of, I am going to challenge you. I'm going to listen to an investor enough. I'm going to be coachable on the things that they don't know. But then I'm also going to have enough confidence on the things that I know as a founder, because this is a really important concept. There is a very large asymmetry of information between founders, which are people that have the information because they operate every day in their business, and any investor or board member who are effectively their bosses in most scenarios, but probably have truly 1/1000th of the information that the founder has.
Right.
Because again, putting on my investor hat, I know a lot about many, many things.
Yes.
And so coachability is about, I'm listening on the topics I don't know, but I'm also going to tell my investor when they're wrong on the things that they do know.
Totally.
Because we don't want to invest in pushovers either. Like,
right.
I will not know about every dynamic of your business. And I need you to be telling me, yeah, Michelle, I tried that and I tried it this way. And this is why I think it didn't work. And unless you see something different, like, why would we do that again?
Sure.
And I'm like, okay, great. You run the experiment. Let's move on to the next idea.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
It's me. Have you ever said no to someone and later thought, gee, I really missed that one?
Oh, of course. My God. Every good investor has a road of incredible deals that they have missed. Like, incredible. This is the sign of a great investor, period.
Yes.
I always say my one that I missed was a girl that came on Dragon's Den. She was this young blonde girl, came on with a baseball cap backwards. And she said, I really wanted to eat less sugar. So I cooked up these candies. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. She's like, oh, I made them in my kitchen. And I was like, this is really good for being made in your kitchen. And she did a deal with Jim on the show. I remember meeting up with her after, and she was like, I have $1 million in sales. I want to raise it like a $25 million valuation. I'm like, oh, that's really, really high, but okay. And she told me, she gave me this look in her eyes where she's like, you know, I'm not going to sell this company for less than $30 million. And I was like, that's a really bold statement for someone who's brand new in business and who has, you know, $1 million in sales. But I remember what the whites in her eyes looked like. Anyway, the joke's on me. Tara sold Smart Suites for $400 million to TPG about a couple years ago. Incredible outcome. Incredible product. I've eaten Smart Suites for years. They're
so good.
Yummy, guilt-free, guilt-free snack. And I'm so proud of her. We're friends now. So we've always stayed in touch and been friends, but I'm so happy for
her. That's so cool. Do you still like the flavored lemonade? The smart water.
Oh yeah, I still do have the odd vitamin water. That's funny. I actually try and like not eat chemical sweeteners anymore, but I mean, once in a while.
You gotta have a little treat.
You gotta have something. Sometimes the world feels like you have to if you move, something is bad for you here.
I know.
What was the newest one? My toothbrush is bad for me because it harbors black mold. I was like, I just can't.
I know. I'm with you.
At some point, it's like too much. Just let me enjoy the coffee with no stress on whatever's in this thing right now. And you know, Judy, the funny one is I remember people go so crazy about this. And I'm like, you know, we used to have like lead in our cosmetics and like full parasites in the water. And like this used to be a lot worse than it is today. So
absolutely. What are the biggest red flags you see in early stage entrepreneurs? What are the biggest red flags you go, no, can't do it?
Yeah. I usually don't do like zero coachability. Like you just like don't want to listen.
Yeah.
Why am I talking?
Right.
That's like silly. Another big red flag is I really don't like small market sizes. People make this mistake where they're like, if I only get 2% of the market, like that's not always the right calculation because it's actually very difficult usually to get 2% of the market. But if market sizes aren't big, it's the same amount of work to build a company for a small market as a big market. And so you can start with a small niche, but it has to be applicable to a big market. And that's where you get really transformational businesses. I think another red flag is like going to be companies that are not using AI now. We didn't just invent the internet or the smartphone. We like invented electricity. This is so wild.
Yeah.
What these models can do right now.
Oh, it's crazy.
And the type of work and the diligence of work and the out, like it's, this should be blowing everyone's socks off. And again, I'm sure there are people when electricity came out, they were like, why? I got candles, like I'm good. Or like I got an oil lamp and this is working well. And like, I've never had a fire, so it's probably not a big deal. There are always those versions. But I think that that would be another big red flag. And then I think founder dynamics are the other one. So again, this is like a marriage. There's no perfect marriage. I've never seen a perfect couple. But there are founders that are respectful and that really care about each other. And then there's founders that truly like hate each other. And I've had a lot of companies that have great businesses, great margins, great unit economics, great markets that fall apart because founders fight. And you'll never be able to mitigate that. Just like you'll never be able to play perfect odds at every wedding you'll go to on which ones are going to make it and which ones are not. But that's really important that those founder dynamics are there.
The other reason I think that you've been a star and that you are a star in all that you do and on the show, and I mentioned this off the top, is that I've seen you tear up and cry on the show when you have to pass someone up. And you always sort of let them down with a, you know, gently with a real pep talk and great compassion. Is it hard to reject some of the entrepreneurs you meet?
There's one really good clip that's on my Instagram of one of this young girl that's a distiller in the East Coast. It's like it's just very emotional. It's so sad to let her down. But I also know that she's going to make it. She's just not ready. And I also think this was a huge thesis at Clearco. If you put an investor in a business too early, you will ruin the business.
Absolutely. You're so right. It's like an on-air person on CBC, a reporter, going out in the field before they're ready to be a reporter, ready to be a journalist. You have to do it at the right time. You're so right.
And if you want a lifestyle business and you take on an investor, it is no longer a lifestyle business.
That's right.
Black and white, cut and dry. My job is to get a return on money. All big VCs, unless they're family offices like mine, they have a fixed return that they are looking for. They are taking a pensioner's money and investing it. It's not like, oh, you can just take a couple of years off. No, no, no. Time's ticking.
That's right.
And so that's the other big problem is founders will come on the show and they'll be like, oh, well, I got time and I got time to have a baby and I got time to do all this. And I was like, no, 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 that's not how investors work. It's very, very different.
Absolutely. You, another reason for your success, and I know this, is that you work like a maniac. You've said this, right? You often would log in 12-hour days. And you've said, and I quote, I've had to miss birthdays, weddings, yeah. I've had to cancel trips. You really remind me of my husband, Dr. Lerak, because that's his, it's 24/7. To be the best, and he is, it's a 24/7 thing. And you have to be married to it. You have to be passionate about it.
And you have to love it. Like, your husband makes babies for people. And the uterus doesn't take Sundays off and it doesn't take evenings off. And
that's like, right. People, you know, ovulate 7 days a week.
Live and die. Like, right. It's just, it's very, very different. And I'm very clear on this, Judy. Like, I think people need to understand what the threshold is to be great.
Yes.
And the threshold is your all.
Yeah.
And I would have never made it if I worked less hard. I could have become more successful if I had timed a couple more markets and ideas better. I just don't think if I had worked 10% less hard, my outcomes would have been even 1% of what they were. Because it's that extra mile, it's that extra pain, it's that extra like thinking about things that made it possible. And I just think that's the price of admission and people need to understand that. And then there's also lots of people that work really hard that don't get to make it. And so I think you have to shift your mindset on the gratitude of, man, I worked really hard.
Yes.
But I also got to enjoy a lot of, you know, the success.
Absolutely. But you have to work hard, but you also have to work smart. And I think you do both. You work hard, but you know how to work smart. And you also once said that in business, you need tough skin, not rose-colored glasses. Yeah. And I think that that's huge. You say so many great things. Are you going to write a book?
You know, I've been thinking about writing a book. I think next year is book year.
Will you come back on when you write the book?
Of course. I would love to share some of it. I've thought about so many things over the years. And both Anatoly and I have shifted our perspective on so many things around building businesses. That I'd love to. I'd love to share some.
I'm a life coach. I can keep you on track with that. And
amazing.
Once in a while. Don't go anywhere. We're just going to go on a short commercial break and we will be right back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We are back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, and I'm here with Michelle Romano of CBC's Dragon's Den. There was a time, Michelle, when you had no money or no connections. You were scared to go and talk to people. You, in fact, rehearsed your first three lines. Hi, I'm Michelle, and this is what I'm working on. I love that. Really nice to meet you. So simple and great. And you've taken that to a place where I think you have every connection in Canada. I was thinking, is your Rolodex plated in gold? There's probably no one in this country, and never mind this country, anywhere in North America or the free world as we know it, that you can't just go and reach out to. Is that true?
I know a lot of people, and I don't really think about knowing people as like knowing people to know them. I think about people at their core and who they are and what I can do to help them and what reminds me of people. And so I find myself like, I'll just send a little note when I see something that reminds me of someone, you know, stuff like that.
That's important. Writing those notes is so important. So as you've said, after a 9-month incubation, I know you're thrilled to introduce your newest and cutest startup, Sasha. How has motherhood changed your whole life with your beautiful little girl? And how are you juggling it all?
Yeah. Okay. So let's start with the beginning. There's no perfect way to juggle a child, right? I think there is, we are biologically designed to have these children literally live on our bodies for the first year of their life. And there is something so magical about that. There's also something so overwhelming about that, because it's not only my job to provide for Sasha, it's my job to provide for my family and for the people that work for me. And there's a few more responsibilities in my life. So having Sasha was like easily one of the most magical things. Every cliche is true. It goes so slow and it also goes so fast. Your heart activates on a whole other level that you cannot feel until you have a baby. And the whole thing is really incredible. So I think I only share that part of the story because I think I was always one of those people who didn't grow up being like, I can't wait to be a mom. I know there's like girls that are, you know, 16 and they're just so excited for when they're going to be a mom. I was like, oh, that would be nice. But it was never the top of my to-do list. And so I think now that I've done it, as someone who is hesitant to do it, 10 out of 10 would recommend to a friend. And I know that sounds silly, but I do think it would have been important for someone like me to hear that, you know, it doesn't just have to be this like incredible desire. I also am like very honest with where I was at my stage in life. I wanted to build a career. I wanted to work like a maniac. I had so much traction that it made sense for me to delay having kids until I was 39 or 40. And now I have a lifestyle where I can spend a lot of time with a baby. I have a lot of work that I can do from home. So I still have a little bit of travel, but you know, I get the help of an incredible partner, incredible in-laws, a nanny. And so there's just so much love around Sasha perpetually. And I also get to spend a lot of time with her, which I would have never done at a conventional 9-to-5 job. I would have never been able to do as an executive. And I wouldn't have ever been able to do if I was in the thicket of my entrepreneurial journey.
I'm so happy for you. And I have to tell you, it only gets better. I have a daughter. We have a daughter who is 25 years old. She's a singer and performer living in New York City.
Amazing.
And a beautiful son who's living overseas and some little baby grandchildren. It only gets better. It is truly one of the best things in life.
Yeah.
You're so young. I'm much older than you, Michelle.
You look like 1 minute older than me.
So sweet. You're young and you look gorgeous and you actually keep you looking younger. You do, because I've looked at all the pictures. I've spent your whole thing. What's your secret? Is it healthy eating, the working out, the diet?
Yeah, I mean, great. You know, I go up to people in coffee shops all the time with great skin that look kind of like great for their age. You know, and you just like have a look that you're like, wow, what are you doing? And I love this idea because I just think the internet is so full of lies sometimes, like so full of everyone that's making money off something. It really shows in your skin the later in life more, right? Like the more garbage you eat, the more alcohol you drink, the worse your skin looks. And like, I'm a person like everyone else. I get a nice dinner every once in a while and you have to like live a little. But I think my secret has a little bit of escaping some of the cold in winter has been really important to me. That's like a really big one. I try and take care of my skin with a skincare routine and I love a good laser and doing all those types of maintenance things that are now available to us that are just so much easier than I think it was ever historically to do some of the stuff. I mean, I'm 40. I grew up in the 90s. I've done every form of diet. You know, anorexia was at its peak in the 90s. Like there was so, I had a point in my life where I'm sure I ate 3 apples a day. Like to me, healthy eating is like just not eating processed foods. And I really try at this age to not count calories. I really try and be like, this is a whole food that I made or someone else made that I know has like no processed garbage in it. And the processed garbage is everywhere. You look at an almond milk and there's like 9 ingredients that are not almonds. Like it's like nutty to me, like truly nutty on the almonds. But you're like drinking almond milk. You like think it's better for you, right? And so and I credit my mother-in-law for this huge level of diligence around, we're just going to eat food that was around 70 years ago.
Right. The best of all.
The best. And yes, it's more work. And yes, you have to cook it all. And yes, it's like annoying. And no, it's not like, and not at every moment, but there is just an unlimited amount of insertion points that it will happen. And so now I think I care a lot less about calories and a lot of more about what's in my food. And that has kept me healthier and looking better than ever. And then look, you got to, at 40, if you're not using your muscles, you were losing them. There's no question about it. I have more muscle. My most proud moment is I like have one of those scales that measures things. I don't know. I think it's accurate, kind of accurate. 80% accurate. But I've had the same one for a while. And I have more muscle mass now than before I had Sasha, which is such a win for me because having a baby is so much rehab. Like I know, I'm just so impressed with
the women. I'm still recovering.
Well, exactly. I'm so impressed with the women that do this 12 times in life, right? Like I have one baby and I'm like, wow, like your apple separates, your pelvic floor, your everything.
Yeah.
And that's all fine. But I just had to go and I had to show up every day and do it. But yeah, those are my best hacks.
Water. Are you a good water girl? Like,
no, I'm a terrible water person. I hate peeing all the time. I'm like, so scarred from peeing every like 10 seconds during pregnancy. And I think actually the ones we talked about earlier, breathing, hypnotherapy, journaling, going inside your own thoughts. Again, every generation is in a different version of what's trying to distract you or kill you, right? And I don't mean to overstate this, but the challenge, if you are, I think, living in North America today, is truly how do you not eat all the processed garbage? And how do you not constantly consume 15-second video clips? Those are the things that are degrading our mind, like truly the fastest.
Yeah.
And it's pretty wild that we've gone from, we're the same ancestors of the people that had not die by lions, right? And not die by Ebola. But this is so important, is that you're just giving yourself, your mind a break from these two minefields. And I am like everyone else. You can spend hours scrolling.
Of course.
And you have done nothing. You've kind of just consumed interesting tidbits of content. So, right. I mean, I think of those as like the two big things to avoid right now.
Smart. Very, very smart. I know that the Science in Humans just announced that you are an investor and a 2026 brand ambassador to champion women's hormone health in Canada. And you said that Canada's hormone therapy market could be as big as $36 billion by 2031. Yeah. That's great that you're doing that.
Yeah.
And you're also mentoring people. That's become a big thing for you, is in this new chapter, if you will.
Can you just
briefly speak to that?
I've focused a lot more on running Athena North, which is my family office, in terms of investing and mentoring founders. I made an investment in Science in Humans and became their ambassador. They really care about access to hormone health for both men and women. Hormones are the operating system of our whole bodies. They tell your body everything to do and to not do. And it's been really, really hard. Historically, this has been misunderstood. You know this because you're married to a fertility doctor. Women used to go to the doctor between 45 and 50 and were truly told that they were just crazy.
Yeah.
And so it's really incredible how now there is like so much science. There's so many things we can do. There's so many tests that we can run. Yeah. And, you know, the average woman in Canada is waiting way too long to be able to do this. So to be able to access a doctor, understand what's happening in your own body
is waiting for permission when you actually don't think you can take matters into your own hands, which is.
And I've been an employer my whole life. I've never understood why I would want an employee of mine worrying about their health in a waiting room for all this time. Like this should be just provided to you so you can truly be your best self at work.
There's a question that we ask everyone at the end of the show. And of course, we're going to ask it to you. What is bliss for Michelle Romanow?
Bliss is like this magical moment of inner and outer peace where you're with your people and your tribe and your partner and your family. And you feel that love, but you've also challenged yourself. And so bliss is like that magic point where like something has worked out and something you've tried really hard has worked out. And you're also with people that make you feel safe on the inside.
That's lovely. What a lovely answer. Cry. It's been an absolute honor to have you on the show today. I have to thank my husband for this one.
Of course.
I'm so grateful to have you on the program and to have met you. And really, I think you're just a bliss person. You really are.
Oh, thank you.
And
thank you.
It's been
lovely. Well, it was so, so lovely to meet you. This is a lovely series of questions and a great conversation. And I think something very real as well. So I hope everyone enjoys it.
Thank you so much. What's the best way for people to contact you, connect with you, follow you on social media?
So follow me. It's Michelle Romanow. Michelle has one L because my parents forgot the second L. And then Romanow is R-O-M-A-N-O-W. I'm very active on LinkedIn, on Instagram, and you can find me there.
I would love to thank our wonderful guest, Michelle Romano, for being on the show today. It was so delightful to have her here. Also, thank you to Meg Ruffman, Siobhan Kylie, producer Lori Quinn, audio engineer Julianne Yanciello, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. Also, a special thanks to Garrett Flores for the beautiful pink roses that adorn our set each week. For everyone here, I'm Judy Lee Brack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.